Good morning, everyone. We're going to wrap up our series with Professor Elaine Friends today, and I just love the title. The WCTU Takes on the World. So let's get started.
Thank you very much. And I was today, I can ensure that I was going to be really good with, hello. Today I came in, sure, I was going to be really good with tech. I know it's the other one. This time, you think her? Is it not me?
Yes, please.
Okay. Can you hear now? Okay. I will try to be clear. Okay. Now I feel very loud. Okay. So, I'm going to invite you at the very beginning of this to think if you have ever considered taking on something and decided it simply could not be done. You realize it was super important that you wanted to do it. It's crucial to you that it be done. But then when you really thought about it, you thought about all the impediments in the way, you know, that you could possibly, oh, you have to do this thing, but then you have to take care of this problem, or keeping you from doing this thing, right? And you realize that, I guess this is the kind of problem that I could solve, right? Because there's just too many big things in my way. There are laws that keep me from doing the things I need to do, right? All sorts of, you know, things. And I was thinking about that and what it must have looked like to say an adult woman, and it's for, you know, I'm just gonna imagine this work, those have been true elsewhere, around the year 1875, as they're starting the crusades at Ogwinnett, they have set up an organization in Cleveland in 1874. And so let's say that there's a woman living a fairly comfortable life. Your average living 60 woman. She's not, it's not necessarily in the suburbs, it's a little bit pre-suburbs, right? So she's either going to be in the city somewhere, or maybe she's going to be rural.
She's going to be, she's going to be prosperous enough, or imagine that you're prosperous enough that you're one of the 80% or 85% of women who are not working, right? So about 15 to 20% of women were working through this period. But let's say the WCTU women usually weren't, because they were a little bit more prosperous than that, which gave them the time. They've been noticing since the Civil War, you've been noticing since the Civil War, that the world is opening up, that you're seeing a lot more products. So the Civil War sort of made the United States more better connected, right? It, you know, during the Civil War, transportation and communication really opened up. Many more companies sort of became national, right? So you're actually getting a lot of media now and products and people coming from elsewhere. So you're living in a much bigger world than you were living in even before the Civil War, even in, like, you know, the 1860s. So in the last 10 years, your world, do I need, is it, my microphone's kind of in the wrong place?
No.
Yeah. Okay. It's working. Okay. Yeah. The world's been kind of opening up. You probably have children at home, or you might, maybe your children have already grown. But even if you have children, it's a lot of work. Your load has grown lighter. You have fewer children than you would have had 20 years before. You know, and you can buy a lot of food now and things like that that you would have had to make before. So you have some free time. Your main social connections are probably your family members, neighbors, and the people at your church. You probably, perhaps, have been involved in some sort of activities at your church, maybe teaching Sunday school, maybe supporting missionaries, maybe supporting missionaries abroad, or missionaries to the Native Americans. We haven't known. Okay. And or maybe you're involved in charity work closer to home with poor people near you. And yet you also know from your home, you know that all is not well in the world. One thing that's really going to be troubling you in the 1870s, around the time of the Women's Temperance Crusade, is labor. There's about to be, you know, in 1877, a massive national strike that the government almost couldn't suppress, right? The government had to send out the army and it kind of ran out of army, right? And that's going to be very much centered in Pittsburgh. More than 100 people are going to be, you know, sort of like gunned down, you know, in that protest, you know, just a couple of years. So like labor is a big issue that's troubling you. Nobody quite knows how to handle the labor problem. You know, and you can know that there's other problems too. You can see a lot of poverty in the streets. In the 1870s, there's actually a depression that started in 1873, right before the Women's Crusade. It's going to last. It's a very serious depression. And so there's a lot of poverty, a lot of joblessness. You know, there's problems in the other parts of the country, like dealing with the consequences of civil war and the struggles of freed people in the South. You're also aware that there's a lot of labor troubles out in the West with Chinese immigrants and, you know, the railroad workers, right? There's a lot of violence and killing of railroad workers over to the West, and you're reading about that in your newspapers. So at home, maybe you're not too happy about some local things. Maybe you're not happy about how the schools are run. Maybe you're not happy about how the municipality manages its funds. Maybe you're unhappy in general about women's lack of power. You know that you can't do anything directly. You know you're supposed to be able to speak through your husband by influencing him. You know you're supposed to raise your sons. And you talk about that a lot. You're supposed to raise your sons to vote like they should, right? And that's your influence, is through your husband and your sons. But you can't help but think that the time has come, right, you know, for you to have more direct influence in some way. And you notice that you're starting to get news accounts that some women in the West are starting to get the vote. That they're actually locally, some states in the West, Wyoming first, is starting to give women the vote in the 1870s. And sometimes the vote for everything, but sometimes just the vote. You can just vote for school board, or you can just vote for, you know, certain kinds of local elections. So you're noticing things are happening, but the women who are pushing these things seem a little bit crazy, you know, and they seem a little bit headstrong, right? And they seem a little bit mannish, unsexed, as you'd say, right? You know, there's these kind of unsexed women who are sort of pushing for rights. And so you're in a situation where you kind of know things need to change. You might have an idea that you wish you could be part of changing them, and you see that some women are starting to participate directly, but they get a lot of negative press, right? And it's embarrassing to be seen as a woman like that, right? Especially if you're a comfortable woman, you know, out here, you know, in the Midwest, a Christian woman, a comfortable woman. So this would be when you start seeing, you know, maybe you participated in a crusade, maybe you went out to march once when everybody was going out to march, right? So maybe you went out to march once, maybe you went out to march, you know, a few times. And now a WCTU organizer shows up in your town, or somebody in your town decides to organize a local chapter of the WCTU. Maybe they show up in a church, right? And the minister maybe gives them time to speak, and they invite you to come and join the WCTU. And so what I want to think about is, what are these women then empowered to do during this period? Because it's an incredible amount. You know, what is it that happens once you join the WCTU? What kind of doors does it open, and what are you able to accomplish? And I want to start by talking about, let's see. There you go. Okay. I'm going to start by talking a little bit about the organization of the WCTU, and then I'll get into some of the issues like local temperance legislation, prohibition legislation. So your life in the WCTU, first of all, the WCTU from its beginning has a local, state, national structure that you guys are probably familiar with from other organizations that you've been in. It's the classic structure in the United States for an organization. So you would go to a chapter meeting probably every week, you know, maybe every month. And then you might join a subcommittee in your chapter that would be dedicated to this or that priority. The committees in each town would be very local, very locally oriented. The state committee answers to the federal or to the national committee. The national committee has an annual convention, but the national convention, the national committee also serves, it has a big, very quickly develops a large permanent staff. Okay, so it has a lot of paid people, you know, within just a year or two who are working for the national committee, and they are creating resources for the locals. So they are starting to do a lot of publication. They're starting to publish things that you could then order at your local to distribute locally. Therefore, they are going to ultimately form 35 standing committees that are each going to deal with a different element of social change that they see as related to temperance. Each of those committees is going to exist at the national level and at the state level. And then each local can decide which part of the work they want to be part of. So if you are in a local who maybe isn't so excited about purity work, prostitution reform, right? If you don't want to get involved in that, you don't have to. You can choose what issues you want to make your own. And you choose that by joining a subcommittee, forming a subcommittee at your local, by buying, you would buy from the national, you would raise money, and you would buy pamphlets that you could then distribute locally about whatever issue you were interested in. You could raise money at your local, and you could pay for a speaker to come out from the state level or from the national level to speak about whatever local issue that you were interested in. And then you could also start local initiatives with the advice of people at the state who were working in that area. You would probably, as a person who joined this, not only would you join the, you'd go to these meetings, but you'd probably put on events. I mentioned these fundraisers, so you'd have a lot of fundraisers, just kind of familiar form. You would also have events like, and these could be the fundraisers, you would put on temperance plays. The National produced many temperance plays, and so you'd put on a play. Or you would have a musical event that you'd put on and maybe sing some temperance songs. That again, the National had a big sheet music publishing organization. So it became this sort of very quickly became this really big deal. It also, the National also published a newspaper, which I mentioned before, the Union Signal. And you would subscribe probably as a WCTU member, subscribe to the Union Signal, which had the largest circulation of any newspaper at the United States at that time, right? And so you'd probably subscribe to the Union Signal, and you'd be reading that, going to a lot of these events. If you got really invested in it, you might start to go to state and national conventions yourself. And then there was really no limit to what you could do. Okay, so I want to talk about the different departments of work. And the first one I want to talk about is obviously the legislation, legislative work. So one thing, and of course, one of the crucial things that the WCT wanted to do was bring about prohibition. And the sort of, when you're teaching this class as a, you know, undergraduate class, one thing you say is, well, the WCTU didn't quite get us to prohibition. They're replaced by a male-led group called the Anti-Saloon League, you know, which kind of brings us across the finish line, right? But the WCTU does exist through this period, and it helps with, you know, the final work in bringing about prohibition, national prohibition. But even before that, it actually succeeded legislatively in getting a lot of local prohibition. So this is just a map from 1915, and it's you know, it really, but throughout this period, the WCTU is succeeding in lobbying for and pushing for and winning, even if they can't vote, lots of local prohibition.
Can you tell us which there, the black or the white?
Yeah, the black is places with prohibition. Yeah, black is places where there are prohibitory laws by 1915. Yeah. In addition to lobbying for prohibition, which was, of course, their core issue, they lobbied for a lot of other laws that they needed in order to do their prohibition work. So, and it was countless laws. You couldn't even mention the, you know, couldn't even really list the number of laws locally and federally the WCTU lobbied for. But it was things like married women's property laws so that women could control their own money, so that their drunken husbands, you know, couldn't own all the money, so that they could have the power to leave their husbands, right? Or the power to control what happened in the household, you know, with a drunken husband. So they fought hard for and succeeded in getting married women's property laws. They fought hard for women's right to testify in court, and to bring their own lawsuits in their own names. So they fought for various rights, for legal rights for women in the courtroom. They fought for something I've written about, which is the Dram Shop Acts. And, you know, like today, if somebody were to go out and hit somebody with a car, you know, while they were drunk, let's say somebody went out to a bar and got really drunk and then hit somebody with a car. You can, and I think it's still true in Ohio now, that that person who was hit by a car or their family members can sue the bar that served them if they had overserved them. Okay, that's a WCTU. Well, this one in Ohio, it actually preceded the WCTU, but in Ohio, but in Pennsylvania and most other states, that's a WCTU law. You know, they pushed for those laws to be passed to say that, and it wasn't obviously about cars at first, but it was that if your husband or father drank too much and harmed you by drinking too much, you can sue the saloon keeper for that damage. And that could be if he loses his job, or if he gets hit by a train, or if he gets injured or whatever, then you can sue for that. And that was a set of laws that was really enabled by the WCTU. They trained people to lobby. They actually have pamphlets, how to learn how to lobby. You know, learn how to testify, learn how to be a makeshift lawyer to go into these cases and represent victims. So they were very serious about that. The WCTU also did, I'm gonna advance this. Oh, I did it again, didn't I? Here, I'm gonna advance it using this tool. Yes, is what I'm gonna do. This isn't me. Oh, there it is. Okay. Okay. The WCTU also worked on education. The WCTU was very interested in training our youth to understand the consequences of drinking. And what did they do about education? What they did was many things. They women in the WCTU often ran Sunday schools for kids. And a Sunday school wasn't necessarily for people in your church, but it was like a Sunday school that kids could come to. And it would they would teach kids in these Sunday schools about the consequences of drink and other sort of immoral activities. They also got legislation passed. They lobbied for classes to be required in the public schools on scientific temperance. They lobbied for that very successfully and got those passed very widely. And then they wrote textbooks and they commissioned textbooks, but they wrote them themselves often and they often commissioned them. And then these textbooks were adopted in the public schools very widely. And you read them and you're like, yeah, they're not bad actually. They were, they weren't horrible. Scientifically, I mean, people knew different kinds of things 100 years ago than they do now, but they weren't like they were pretty scientifically accurate for the day. They really and they also, as somebody brought up before, they opened kindergartens. Right. They did a lot of work on trying to sort of educate our youth so that they would be less likely to succumb to the problems of alcoholism later in their life. Okay. They also worked, and this came up early, and this is so important. They worked really hard against domestic violence. Now they're not going to succeed, right? We know that, even today we haven't dealt with many of the problems of domestic violence. I mean, certainly not until the late 20th century are we really going to have laws that really make it illegal to, beat your wife. So they're not going to get that. They worked on it. And one thing that they did was tell stories of domestic violence. This woman here is, her name is Mother Eliza Stewart. She was actually one of the first crusaders. She's from Ohio. And her thing was domestic violence. She spent her basically her career in the WCTU telling stories of domestic violence. And these stories really had not been told. Like it was not appropriate to write about, in fiction, people didn't talk about it. And Mother Stewart went out and told, really grim stories of domestic violence. And I have a little quote from her, from one of her talks here. What blood-curdling pictures were those that the drunkard's wife gave of the drunkard's home? Whole nights had he kept her and her children in terror. On one occasion, he came home insanely drunk, locked the door, took his axe, sharpened and examined the edge, telling the children he was going to chop their mother up. And she and they knew if anything, however trivial, should go wrong, he would carry on that threat. He laid her on the floor and would go through the motions as if he was going to strike. The wretched victims of this horrid pastime, not daring to resist or protest. The wife keeping a cheerful smile, saying, "Why, John, I know you're only in fun." While she could hear her heart beat, and this through long, weary hours of the night, with no deliverance near, until the effect of the liquor at length overpowered him and he sank into a beastly stupor. So she would go out and tell stories like this, just relentlessly. And she also herself became a self-trained lawyer and represented battered women in court. Which was again seen when she first did it as maybe inappropriate, right? But she stood in and she, because she was in there and she was very aggressive, in defending the rights of these battered women. Now you'll notice that what they're actually doing is saying the solution to the problem of battered women is prohibition, right? They still aren't getting to the place where they're not asking for specific legislation to protect battered women. But what they are doing is they're trying to give battered women access to the courts. They're trying to get them access to money. And they're trying to cut off the supply of alcohol because they did believe that without alcohol, the battering would cease, right? So that was a huge part of their campaign. They also used their connections to economically assist struggling families, including families where husbands had been abusive, so that women could support their families. They helped find employment for battered women at a time when it was, you know, often hard for women to find employment. Okay, I don't have a slide for this one. Oh, maybe I do. I can't remember if I ended up adding that. Oh, I did. Good for me. Okay. Prison work. They did a huge amount of work in the prisons. And this was, you know, again, something some locals took up and others didn't. But they would go into the prisons. They did things like regular visits to the prisons to talk to and bring treats and, you know, snacks and food to the incarcerated people. You know, they would pray with them, you know, and do things like that. And they would also try to reform the prisons. They tried to bring issues. They had whole committees that were working nationally at the state level and locally to try to reform prison conditions. They often saw these men as victims of drink. And they believed that these men kind of in some ways were as much victims of the sort of liquor trade as you know, the people that they might have attacked. They also set up special, they pushed for prison matrons, for female prison guards, so that women who were incarcerated could have dignity and be under the care of women, so that also they would not be subject to assault from male guards, right? So they pushed for prison matrons. They also pushed for special courts for women who were accused of things, particularly sexual crimes. So they start, they're pushing in a lot of ways for sort of carceral justice. And I'll kind of zoom through some of the rest of this. They push for things like, okay, rescue work. They work with a lot with prostitutes, right? They do things like fight the double standard, which they talk about, of sexual morality. They talk about the white life for two, and that is that the only proper relationship between men and women is a relationship of sexual purity on both sides, you know, a relationship sort of without unholy lust, right? They have a committee for work with fallen women. They changed that to the Department for Social Purity in 1885. They stress practical measures. They provide temporary housing for women fleeing prostitution called life-saving stations. And this is actually one of their houses that they set up for women who are fleeing prostitution. They set up places for young girls entering the city for the first time to live. They also set up sex education for children, right? So that they could learn some of the basics of sex, which they feel will help with social purity going forward. They also work on rape prevention. And they do that in part, one of their most important legislative efforts is to get the age of consent laws raised. So the age of consent for girls, it was 10 to 12 years old in most states. And it was really the WCTU during this period who gets it raised to 16 in most states. So they're working on protecting girls from sexual assault as well. They're working on world peace. Peace, and they're also, when working on world peace, they're also working on labor peace, right? They're working on what they call their Peace and Arbitration Committee. I'm gonna forget her first name. Her last name is Bailey, but I didn't write down her first name. She's actually fascinating. I'd like to learn more about her. But she's actually pushing for, you know, basically nonviolence, both in labor relations in the, you know, in policing and in global affairs. They're pushing for, she set up the International Department of Peace and Arbitration, published monthly periodicals on pacifism for adults and for children. and distributed hundreds of thousands of pacifist leaflets and crusaded against military conscription, the draft, military drills, and military toys. And she also crusaded against lynching in the South. So just a nonviolent position. And she was the head of the committee, but you could join that committee at your local as well. And of course, they're pushing for suffrage work as well. So in 1876, just 2 years after the Crusades, Frances Willard declares herself in favor of female suffrage. She immediately gets a letter from Susan B. Anthony, who says, "Thank God, I'm so glad." They never actually got along. They were actually politically very different in a lot of ways, but they really came together on the issue of temperance. They pushes, and Frances Willard encourages the WCTU to adopt a pro-suffrage position nationally. And in 1881, they finally do. They declare in favor of what they call the Home Protection Ballot in 1881. That means that women should have the vote, and women should have the vote in order to be able to protect their homes. Okay. They have several different subsections of their committee. They're interested in different groups within the United States. The work among Black Americans, and this is Frances Harper, who's a very famous Black reformer in the 1800s, who was the head of the WCTU Department of Work on Black Americans. Work among colored people. Unfortunately, one reason that they had to have that department, they actually had to segregate they did segregate the WCTU into white and Black, or they allowed for segregated WCTUs because they wanted to bring in Southern whites. Southern whites wouldn't be part of the WCTU unless they could have segregated chapters. So they did allow for, though they did not require, segregated chapters. And this is kind of part of that. Harper finally has to, at some point, say, you know, you have to, she says, quote, "In dealing with colored people, Christian courtesy must be shown." So she had to, you know, speak out to the white WCTU because of some of the racism she was encountering within the organization. And then there was a famous incident with Frances Willard, her low point, where she seems to support lynching. Where she says she understands lynching because lynching was in response to rapes of white women. And she says it's, you know, white women are scared to go out from underneath their own roof tree because of the threat of lynching, and that therefore she has some sympathy for, like, the lynchers. So she unfortunately, that was her moment that she gets a certain amount of criticism for. Ida B. Wells, an important Black reformer, basically went on the road all, you know, around the globe fighting back against Frances Willard on that statement. And ultimately, Frances Willard does apologize and kind of reel it back. But that was definitely a low point. And then the last thing I want to mention is the world. Also work among Native Americans. There's actually a really good book that just came out about the WCTU's work among Indigenous people. Okay, and they actually changed their motto from God and home. They decide they need to stretch beyond the United States. They changed their motto from this, which was "For God and home and Native land." Ta-da. I was trying to be fancy and I failed, but to "For God and home and every land." So they become international in the 1880s. This is the Polyglot Petition, which is a petition that was circulated globally, and then they glued it all together. This is Frances Willard Lady Henry Somerset standing in front of the Polyglot Petition, which still exists. They still have it stored somewhere. And that was a petition for a global prohibition, or for, like, you know, for the end of alcohol. They sponsored a bunch of around the world missionaries. They had more than 30 women who went around the world being paid by the WCTU to spread the temperance message to every continent. They held huge rallies around the world, these around the world missionaries. They held huge rallies, not only on temperance, but on others. So this is a social purity rally, you know, so they go around the world kind of spreading a lot of the different things that the WCTU stands for globally. This is just an example. This is a sort of fair in New Zealand, and the WCTU, if you see that big tent in the back, the WCTU has like a tea house so that you don't have to drink at this fair, and you don't have to drink alcohol. You can have some tea instead with the WCTU. But it truly was global, and they did a lot of global work. And I was just to sort of finish this up. I was looking yesterday, kind of thinking about, because the WCTU actually still exists. It's not real vibrant. It got really excited. The war on drugs was very exciting for it. You know, it definitely got all in on the war on drugs. But in the last few years, it's fallen upon some hard times. I noticed they just lost control of the house, like this year, her house they've been using as a museum. And I noticed that just in the last few months, they don't control that anymore. So the WCTU is having some problems today. But they set up this international infrastructure, and I was just going through, and I noticed that on Facebook, the Indian WCTU is alive and well, and this is something they did just a few months ago. They had a sort of white ribbon, you know, image of they're calling for prohibition, is what they're fighting for there. But you can actually find WCTUs still in operation in various places around the world, even though in the United States, it is defunct. So kind of looping back to this sort of woman kind of sitting here thinking, you know, what can I do? In 1875, it was these women who fueled, you know, all of this. I mean, they had the amazing leadership of Frances Willard, Mother Stewart, you know, and others. But it was really these regular Midwestern Christian, largely middle-aged women who made all of that happen. So it was pretty impressive, I think. We ought to think about these people more, in my opinion. So
I missed last week, so perhaps you talked more about Frances last week.
Mm-hmm.
But I did some reading about her several years ago, and I did a little paper in graduate school. But she seemed to really respond more to me for the challenge and the power that the organization gave to her. I mean, she was doing some pretty boring things to me in retrospect. Teaching. That was all that was available.
Teaching's wonderful. Yeah.
But she seemed to just blossom, mm-hmm, once she found the WCTU. And I wondered if it was more what she could do and important that she could be rather than the purposes of the organization. I know that's pretty harsh, but it just struck me that way.
What's harsh?
She worked phenomenally hard, and she was very gifted.
Uh-huh. But she would not have existed if it was not, she was made by the organization.
Yes.
No, I totally think that. And I think, like, for her, I think she had a situation. I love that way. That's how I think about it. Right. You know, I think if she hadn't been there, they would have found somebody else. I think the power, the motive force was coming from the bottom. Right. And I think they were going to push somebody up, you know, into that kind of place. I mean, that's what I think. I mean, I think these women made themselves a leader. And I think Frances Willard, she was always getting, people needed her, you know, and she's always being, you know, called upon to do this and that. And I think she was sort of you know, drafted sort of to become this person.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. Mm-hmm. Many leadership has come that way. The situation made the leader. Abraham Lincoln can be described that way. But that's an interesting, it was such an interesting time for her to be able to have that opportunity. So much was changing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. That's a really good point.
I'm curious about how this was received in England, where, if I'm understanding my timing right, it was back when there was below stairs and above stairs. And was that something that, sorry, I'm all of a sudden losing my voice. Anyway, how was that something that was segregated along class, the response to this?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So I didn't give a lot of context to this temperance movement compared to other temperance movements, right? Because they're already in England by this time, and also in the United States, were working class men's temperance movements, right? Those already existed in both places. So in the United States, it was the Washingtonians, which was basically all male. It was like AA, honestly. It was very similar to AA in a lot of ways. People would tell their experience stories, right? They would have friendships and like support each other through sobriety, right? Things like that. But that was a working class movement. And I can't remember what the one in England was called, but England also had a very powerful working class men's temperance movement. Right. So this was only, there was huge temperance activism in England. There were massive temperance rallies. But the WCTU was only one of many temperance organizations operating then in England. But you're right, they tended to be split by class. There tended to be working class ones, and the WCTU one would have been a middle class organization. Though they tried, right? They would try, but you know, they tried to be more broad. But even in the United States, the WCTU tended to be a middle class to upper class movement. Yeah.
You mentioned the funding. Was this more of a grassroots effort, or were there organizations that were helping to fund this group that appears to have become pretty large, and with all these programs, somehow they had to be funded?
So in the last few years, there have been some really interesting research projects on how social movements were funded historically. And particularly, there was a really good one on the suffrage movement. It's so important, and people tend to not think about it, but you think about a lot of people are making some money, right, doing this. And we have no idea like who's profiting from this, but there was, I mean, you don't think about Westerville, Ohio as being like a great, you know, center of, you know, commerce, but Westerville, Ohio, it became a massive publishing house for, you know, a couple decades, largely because of this. Like, it brought all sorts of money in there. So, but very few people have followed the money trail, which is going to be my long and evasive way to say, I honestly know nothing about how this was funded. I mean, I'll say how I've always assumed it works. And I know that to some extent, this is true. The people who were involved in this movement were, prosperous, right? We're either middle class, and then they had a lot of very upper class people involved in the movement. So one of the women who headed one of their national organizations, it was actually their division of hygiene, which I didn't talk about because it's eugenics, you know, but she was actually Kellogg, you know, or something like that, you know. So what you have is, yeah, I think she was, you know, whatever, like, you know, Sue Kellogg or, you know, whatever, you know, but, you know, you basically do have, especially in the people in power, right, tend to be very wealthy. And so I think you have, a lot of money coming from just the women's, really, it's coming from their husbands, right? but it's largely a sort of middle class, upper class movement, and gets their money that way. And they need it because they're being opposed everything. And I didn't talk about the opposition, but everything that they're doing, all the legislation they're trying to pass is being opposed by German immigrants, right? German immigrants, and they're a whole nother story, but like, you know, German immigrants are out there, you know, forming their personal liberty associations, saying, you know, it's like Schlitz does not like this whole thing, right? You know, and so, you know, you're getting all sorts of pushback at everything that they're trying to do. So they need to do the lobbying, you know, just like we know today, it was about money. Yeah, so it's a really good question, and I wish I could answer it.
So was that Mrs. Kellogg, the cornflake lady?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So it's like, you know, but these big, you know, wealthy families are donating a lot to these reform groups.
And he was quite a piece of work.
Yes. Mm-hmm. A reformer himself, right? A health reformer. Yeah.
Mm. On many levels.
Yeah.
So I'm apologize if it's my deficit, but I'm not sure I'm coming away with a clear understanding of the trail from the Victorian era to the Prohibition era, and how WCTU rose or fell during the advent of Prohibition.
Yeah, so basically what happens is the WCTU prospers during the life of Francis Willard, right? Francis Willard dies in, was it 94? But, you know, 90, or maybe it's 97. And after that, the WCTU goes into a period, you know, it starts to gradually decline. It remains, I mean, it continues to exist, but it just gets smaller and smaller each year. And it has national conventions up until 23, you know, or something like that, you know. So, but then basically with the coming of Prohibition, its reason for existence seems to, you know, dwindle. They think that they won. They stop having their national conventions around 23. They're getting smaller and smaller. At the same time, you have these men's groups, and particularly the Anti-Saloon League, which is going to do this on business principles, right? And they're going to like, we're going to get these ladies, you know, they're always arguing about, you know, the curtains, and like, they're always, you know, they're always having these lemonade stands, you know, and we're going to do this like businessmen, right? And they rise up at the very end of the 19th century is when you start getting that sort of masculinization. So in a way it's because the WCTU declines, but another way it's because they're sort of men get interested in this. Right. And men themselves decide, well, we're going to be, and there begins this sort of, you know, we talked about sort of like muscular Christianity, right? There gets to be this sort of powerful men's reformist Christian left, right? And part of what happens is that group starts saying, move over, ladies, like we're going to make this happen. Right. And I think that's largely what happens.
So was it the men's organizations that pushed Prohibition over the finish line, or was it the remnants of WCTU, or just, you know?
Well, they're all working together.
Who has their fingerprints on it?
Yeah, they're all working together. But the way you could put, if you want to say that women were crucial, you know, part of what happens is women's suffrage, right? You know, and so, you know, part of what happens, a lot of the seeds that are being planted, you know, start to, you know, by the WCTU are taking root, and state by state, women are getting the vote, right? And so part of what happens is that women do, and then women, because of some of the things that the WCTU has been pushing for, you know, women understand how to lobby, you know, women are getting more, to just be more of a political force, whether by voting or by other means. And so, part of it is, you know, I think that the Anti-Saloon League did push it over the top, right? You know, chronologically, it was definitely much more powerful at the time that Prohibition passes. But I would say without the WCTU, it wouldn't have set the stage for any of that to happen. Yeah. That's a little depressing, isn't it? Yeah. But the point is, it was nice not to own prohibition once it passed anyway. We can blame that on the, because that was a mess. We can blame all that on the Anti-Saloon League.
Well, thank you very much. This has been fascinating. So much learning.
Thank you.